Bitcoin.
We can end it there.
That's it. That's all we have for this week.
All guys. We need to say. Frankie. Thank you, Frankie, for all your contributions.
What a weekend. As if you're watching this, as you may be able to tell, I'm on the road. I'm currently in Birmingham, Alabama at an AI power summit gathering of the minds, if you will. Beautiful city, by the way. Walking around this morning, incredible architecture. A lot of old, beautiful buildings. Birmingham, slept on. I'll say that. What's not being slept on right now, Bitcoin, currently charging towards $80,000. Last I checked, it was about $79,000 on the dot. Right now, it's right below it, just went over, a little volatile, $79,020. A lot going on over the last 4 days, and a lot of this pertains to what's going on outside of Bitcoin, a lot of which we've been talking about and discussing for the last 6 months. John, on that note, I'll throw it to you. How would you describe the setup right now?
Well, you know, we did say in the last episode, after the months and months of coiled spring, you know, Bitcoin usually aggressively moves either up or down. So we kind of basically told you what was going to happen, right? So I hope everyone acted on that very clear guidance. No, I mean, it's, we were discussing before we went live, is it a bull trap or not? You know, I think you break up of 80K and it probably starts to look tougher to call it a bull trap, but, you know, I really I don't know that there's a lot of profit in trying to call the direction. I think there are a lot of headlines that came out last week, which we'll discuss, that changed the setup interestingly and, you know, put this kind of moment in time in I think relatively unique context relative to prior cycles. So if you gun to my head, am I more bullish than bearish? Yeah, but I'm always more bullish than bearish on Bitcoin. So take that for what you will.
I am too. A permabull, if you will, but seeped in theory and fundamentals, sound fundamentals. One of the fundamentals of Bitcoin, as Satoshi said in the early emails, is that governments and central banks cannot be trusted not to debase the fiat currencies. And it seems like we're reentering that here in the United States, and not necessarily debasement of the currency, but a backstopping of treasury markets, which, John, I mean, to your credit, for many months, has been, we've been following the development and the maturation of the AI theme. You made it very clear, abundantly clear, that this is a national security issue at the end of the day, and the Treasury will pull out all the stops to make sure that this moves forward and markets don't get disturbed and freak out. And last week, August 19th, as you've had here, we had basically the starting gun for the Bitcoin run. I think Bitcoin reacted 45 minutes after this headline hit, but Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent came out and said that they were going to increase the size of nominal long end liquidity support, so buybacks from $2 billion per operation to at least $4 billion per operation. Not a lot nominally, but I think a bigger signal that, okay, we're here to backstop this market.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a ton to say on this. And I think it's, you know, to frame up the whole discussion, you're right. Like, I mean, it's AI, but it's also a few other themes that we've talked about in the past that we're going to definitely have occasion to discuss more on this episode. But there are a lot of nationally strategic important things, or things that are at least believed and perceived to be of strategic importance to the current administration, kind of in the air right now. The plane is kind of on fire, and we are, you know, trying to gracefully land it. And so I think there's not going to be the current admin is not going to go down without a fight on kind of dealing with all those things and try to, you know, optimize for them all at the same time. I think this is an interesting development for a variety of reasons. I mean, number one, you said the headline here is, you know, Treasury doubles, you know, buyback support starting next month. And that's factually true. But we're also talking about going from, you know, $2 billion to $4 billion per monthly operation here of a program that's already kind of been up and running. You know, you think about relative to the size of monthly or quarterly auctions, I guess, for the longer end, monthly auctions for the shorter end, the size of those, the size of, you know, the outstanding kind of U.S. debt burden. You know, interesting to see that this got so many feathers ruffled and got the debasement trade, you know, moving so hard on just what is ultimately nominally like a very small, you know, amount of buyback increase, right? So that's kind of number one. Number two, and, you know, we don't have a chart on this, but I think this happened and yields on the long end came down by 10 or 15 basis points kind of immediately. This, you know, the headline was greater liquidity support for long end. And then 24 hours later, basically yields were kind of back to where they were prior to the announcement. And I think there was a lot of like, you know, depending on who you are, a lot of like either hand wringing or victory lapping on basically Treasury being out of control. And, you know, this is it. Here comes the massive printing or here comes the collapse of the Treasury market. Here comes, you know, the Weimar Republic kind of phase for the US dollar. And I think I guess the logic of that being like, you know, Bessman has lost control and even his, you know, increased buybacks can't do anything for, you know, to hold long end yields down more than like 24 hours. But I think, you know, if you flip to maybe the next slide, there are a couple of like really interesting things to consider here. And I think we should say as an asterisk to what I'm about to say, it's totally correct that I think there are like nonlinear things that can happen and nonlinear shocks to the system that can happen that can throw everything that I think Bessin is looking at out of whack and, you know, move everything back quickly to kind of printing the difference and doing what needs to be done to keep the flaming plane kind of in the air. But with that said, I think there's probably like an understatement or a lack of sufficient characterization of the toolkit and the weapons that the Treasury has to kind of do what they want to do here. This top headline was not in the newsletter from last week because it just hit this morning. But, you know, sources are saying, right, like many people are unidentified sources are saying that the TGA, so the Treasury is basically like checking account, could be used to fund bond buybacks. That's basically $1 trillion right now. You know, it varies kind of seasonally. Generally, I believe they like to keep it at like, you know, no lower than a few $100 billion to maybe $500 billion. And so there's limits to what could be done there. But I think, first off, just from a TGA perspective, like if they were going to use, you know, the TGA to fund this, and you can imagine that if this headline hit CNBC, you know, Monday morning before market open, then the source of it might be a guy who looked like Scott Bessent in Groucho glasses. But, you know, if that's going to happen, okay, well, that's a lot of firepower in the first place. And the other piece to think about is like, how big is short end issuance that would be needed to kind of fund these buybacks in the first place. The numbers escape me, but, you know, we're talking like hundreds of billions, you know, per, I believe, per month, maybe per quarter. But in any case, it's quite a lot bigger than, you know, $4 billion. So I think the operative question is like, what do you need to do just to keep the plane kind of going, to keep bond volatility dampened, to keep yields in a place that are where they can be like stomached for the short term? You know, I don't think it's necessarily like, you know, $200 billion a month, right? Is it six? Is it eight? Is it 10? I don't know. And I think it's ultimately probably above my pay grade and maybe more closer to the pay grades of the guys in this screenshot that we'll talk about. But your point is, I think the market is perhaps all the headlines that are saying like, oh, they've lost control, they have no idea what they're doing, and they don't have any more firepower, I think are not realizing that what we're looking at here is much more, looks to me like more of an opening salvo than, you know, a last shot, right?
Yeah, I mean, I tweeted it out, or excuse me, I wrote a newsletter on a Friday, just like to your point. I think because of your guidance week in, week out on the show, I have the John Arnold little angel on my shoulder when I'm thinking about like jumping on Scott Bessent and the Treasury. Little angel John Arnold pops up. He's like, there's a bigger plan to this. And that's what I wrote about on Friday. It's like, hey, you may disagree. You may like think things are crazy and you may not agree with the posturing, but if you take a step back and like we discussed last week, like lead up to all the coil, we had some pretty good predictive power last Monday when we met. But like we said last week, you have the Treasury going to do whatever, now almost implicitly coming out this morning with sources and saying we'll do whatever it takes, like somewhat of a Mario Draghi moment. But then you have all these things moving in the background with the OCC, the SEC, the CFTC, basically saying we don't care about Clarity Act. We're going to go make these rules and rejigger the architecture on the back end to facilitate these digital assets, which could, I mean, again, implicitly support the Treasury markets. And then on top of that, I think to your point, this is an opening salvo. I tweeted out this morning. I mean, you compare the support that Scott Bessent and the Treasury are giving to the bond market right now, and you compare it to something like the 2023 banking crisis where they had a Jerome Powell to step in with BTFP. You compare it to 2020, obviously with COVID, Fed and the Treasury to step up with big support and then go all the way back to 2008. This is really interesting that we have like a whatever it takes moment when you have stocks near all-time highs, you have economic data within a range of healthiness, I would say. And I think we're in a very risk-on moment as well. So I just think comparing it to other interventions, whether it's via the Fed or the Treasury in the past, it is kind of unique where we are right now.
Yeah, no, it's fair and it's a good point. I think, I mean, you could make the other argument that, you know, is this is this like 07, right? Like right before all the shoes start to drop and, you know, you're at or near all time highs and everyone's feeling good with their, you know, their cheap ARMs and, you know, the cascading consequences of subprime had not become fully apparent. And like, you know, maybe you're right at the Pico top and it's all about to, you know, come crashing down. I think for a variety of reasons, the setup doesn't look really remotely like that, but it'd be fair to keep that in the back of our minds. And I want to make it clear too, that I'm not like, I'm really not like a Bessent fanboy or a fanboy of anyone who, you know, works in Washington. I just think it's useful and helpful to, you know, always revisit priors and not just map the, you know, they say like generals always fight the last war, you know, as you're looking at your portfolio, looking at how you want to structure your, you know, your life and plan out for the next 10, 20 years. Like it's helpful to not just say, well, this kind of thing happened last time under a totally different set of circumstances. So it's definitely going to happen exactly the same way again. And I think to maybe dive in a little bit to that point, to this chart here on the bottom, which I just ripped shamelessly from Mind Print Hash with Cameron Otsuka and Matt Dines. Again, highly recommend everyone go listen. And Dines will explain it a lot better than I can. And I recommend you just, you know, hear what he has to say. But I think this gets at the question of firepower and kind of the question of like, what are we actually optimizing for here if you're the Treasury? And Matt pulled together data from basically the last kind of rolling 5 years of last year and last year, and then the 3 year average before, of basically the composition of the takedown of new long end Treasury auctions. So who are the buyers, right? By different categories. The font may be too small to see here, but the numbers that stand out, those big lines, are investment funds broadly. I think that it can mean a lot of different things. You know, whether that's like your, yeah, I think he gives the example of PIMCO, so like your classic like massive bond fund, or, you know, also like potentially like hedge funds and more levered vehicles. It all kind of flows into that investment funds category. And, you know, his point is like they're the big buyers right now. The marginal major kind of offtake valve, you know, is not really the Fed. The Fed's on there at the far left. And it's not really the Fed anymore. It's these big investment funds. And so what you kind of need is a way for that game to continue to be played, for the music to keep going, for, you know, big investment funds to come in and remain like a meaningful marginal buyer of new issuance at the long end. And there's all of these, a lot of them sit with these investment funds. They also sit at other accounts, but there's a massive amount of long-end treasuries trading below par, you know, that were issued prior to the massive rate hiking cycle of 22 and 23. So you've got all these bonds that are underwater. And can you go in and basically through some amount of regular buyback, take those out of circulation, take them out of you know, the sitting in these investment funds portfolios, and in so doing add back capacity for them to come back in and, you know, buy new issuance at higher rates? And can you also kind of separately, you know, help to pump equity markets, or at least keep them going, such that there's kind of a rebalancing effect where if you have, you know, both broadly speaking, stocks and bonds, stocks go up, need to rebalance to maintain certain ratios. Okay, well, that's more, you know, buying pressure as well into long end treasuries. And so there's a lot there. Again, I recommend you listen to kind of Matt on it. But I think the question is like the operative question to me, which I wrote about this week, is like, how much are we talking in a given month, any given quarter, to kind of keep that line on the chart, or those lines on the charts, kind of, you know, where they are or increasing? Like, what's the capacity that you need to, you know, to come in and take out? And it's a game that's played at the margin, right? You don't need to do hundreds of billions, probably, right, per month to kind of keep that flywheel going. You need
famous last words.
Well, yeah. Hey, you know what? And I think we'll get to it at the end. If you need hundreds of billions per month, the good thing is that kind of the conclusion is going to be the same either way as it relates to maybe asset allocation and what we're bullish on. Because I think there are a couple different ways it could play out, and they both kind of lead to one path. But all that is to say, like, if you were of the view that there is some marginal offtake that needs to happen to kind of keep this going for longer, you don't have to be. It's as the saying goes, you don't have to be faster than the bear. You have to be faster than the slowest guy running from the bear. And, you know, similarly, you don't necessarily need to solve what is, without a doubt, a meaningful, massive, long run, unsustainable fiscal situation today. You just need to not get shaken out of your trade today. And the trade being like Iran, the trade being, you know, establish new dollar system that's, you know, maybe more favorable to the U.S. government. Trade being establish new relationships with China and the rest of the world vis-a-vis trade. Well, we'll talk about that in a second. But I think that's basically the fundamental intuition, I think, of this chart is like, you know, identify like what's the marginal amount we need to do just to keep this running and not get shaken out basically by, you know, yields and bond volatility for the next 2 years.
Yeah, but definitely. And I want to piggyback on something you said in the beginning of that monologue, which is, I'm not a fanboy either. I wrote this newsletter on Friday. Everybody's like, oh, look at you. You're a Sucoiner now. It's like, I'm just trying to articulate what I think may be happening. It's not as straightforward as many people are making it out to seem. And I think it is pretty calculated, and it is a go big or go home moment for the U.S. and the Treasury specifically. And to your point, we have many different variables, one of them being the war in Iran and its effect on oil and gas markets. And we had some, I guess, that's positive news today with the crude oil stockpiles increasing.
Yeah, it's, you know, just some. So this is obviously, it flows back into the prior discussions, right? Is, you know, energy is you know, the massive input to ultimately to rates that the U.S. And all of your governments don't really have, you know, direct kind of control over. You know, you can't, as the saying goes, you can't print atoms. And, you know, ripping oil prices are very bad for the game that's, you know, that's trying to be run right now. And I just thought it was interesting, kind of like, you know, counter consensus narrative violation that, you know, we talked about the SPR being down to 1982 levels, and that's, you know, no doubt not what you want to see. The flip side being just, you are seeing this recent uptick in commercial crude stockpiles, and, you know, that's right in line with, interestingly, you can't totally make it out on that chart down on the left, but in line with basically 5-year average. So that's kind of an interesting data point for, you know, the direction of, you know, energy prices. But I think I just want to pause on this thing on the right, which is, you know, reporting from Axios, which was later confirmed by, you know, tacitly confirmed by a variety of U.S. you know, military sources. Now you could say like that's, you know, Axios is propaganda, just like, you know, the Iranian state media is propaganda. Okay, maybe. But it looks like the U.S. has been conducting these covert operations literally just in the dark around this Omani traffic lane, basically, to escort a lot of oil out of the Strait of Hormuz over the last few weeks. And this characterizes it as 10 million barrels a day, or about half of pre-war volume. So maybe that's helping you know, see, you know, marginal compression of upward price pressure. I saw this headline and I was just like cackled, because it's like the idea that like you're just waiting until dark to sneak out. I would have thought Iranian drones could have had night vision enabled, and that by itself wouldn't have been that much of a benefit. But in any case, I just find it hilarious that we're basically just sneaking through under cover of darkness to keep energy prices down. But as we talked about, it's one of a million like little things you can do on the margin to kind of keep the game going when maybe it wouldn't have been so obvious.
That's one of a million. And we have a few other of those million here with these headlines: trade war, trade posturing, if you will, the U.S. using and flexing its economic and military might to pressure counterparties in trade to do certain things. And we have a few headlines here. Trump orders the Pentagon to scale back joint exercises with South Korea. Mexico weighs tougher trade rules for China as U.S. talks grind on. Move would deepen Mexico's alignment with Washington, while President Sheinbaum pursues an extension of the USMCA pact with Trump. And then U.S. and Canada getting into it. U.S. and Canada fail to reach a tariff deal and have a deepening trade war here. And then you have the United States Trade Representative Twitter account come out with a very strongly worded tweet about Canada specifically.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is so, you know, I alluded to it earlier, but basically, you know, along with AI and Iran, you've got kind of this global economic reordering, as Treasury Secretary has put it. And, you know, that's happening in U.S. trade. And again, you can agree with this or disagree with this, but I think there's an interesting set of commonalities here on all of these. The South Korea one is notable because if you saw our president's Truth Social post about this, you know, he took some time out to praise everyone's favorite neighbor, Kim Jong-un, in talking about how, you know, South Korea has not been sufficiently kind of grateful to the U.S. for its help in various things, various initiatives. And I think if you look at what kind of just happened, wrote about in the newsletter, but there have been recent, you know, instances of footsie basically between South Korea and China and Chinese trade representatives. And so, you know, that's obviously the administration's trigger point here. And I think there are a lot of people who looked at that Truth Social post and were baffled by like, oh, why would you kind of, you know, poke an ally like this, especially one that's so helpful in the region. And you know, I think if you just look at recent headlines, like it's pretty clear that they're not happy with the way that that relationship has gone. Again, you can agree or disagree with that, but my point is like that, Mexico, and ultimately Canada as well, like all these headlines that hit in the last week on kind of trade and international relations, like the Rosetta Stone on that continues to be China, right? If you look at what Jameson Greer posted, the U.S. Trade Representative, in this tweet, if you're watching on video, you know, I've highlighted the basically the next last paragraph, but talking about how the U.S. partnership, the trade agreement that was being discussed between Canada and the U.S., which fell apart in the 11th hour, fell apart because Canada was, you know, was not interested in or pushed back against the U.S.'s focus on cooperating on export controls, combating transshipment. Okay, that's a big one. Scroll down a little bit. The offer would have led to supply chain coordination on things like unfair trade practices. Okay, critical minerals cooperation. Okay, increased enforcement against imports produced with forced labor. Like, okay, like, you know, we're saying it without saying it, like this is all about China. And again, I think if you've been watching the show for a while, you know, listening to us, like that probably won't come across as like too much of a surprise. But if you look at the mainstream coverage on this, again, it's just like, oh, why would Trump do this to our closest trade ally, you know, our neighbor to the north? And it's like, again, you don't have to agree with it or any of his methods, but like, it's not that mysterious what's going on, right? Like, it's this all kind of, I think, you know, comes through one lens. And at the risk of man with a hammer syndrome, where, you know, man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail, like, there's a lot of smoke here, again, you know, suggesting that there's one focus point and that this is a big piece of the strategy and the plan that they have to land right now. So just telling you, like, this continues to escalate and does not look like it's going away.
No. I mean, you have Mark Carney, you have the Davos WEF plant as the new prime minister of No Anymore. If you're paying attention, listen to your Luongo, listen to your Matt Dines, okay? There's power moves being made behind the scenes. Moving on to something that's not directly connected to any of this, but I think we've been not baffled, but we've been talking about this for the last week behind the scenes, is this headline in I guess private credit insurance markets pertaining to the sale of the Los Angeles Lakers and potential sale of the Dodgers by Mark Walters, who's an insurer, and he's got himself in a bit of a pickle here. If you've been listening to Nick Namath, I've had him on the show a couple of times already this year, but he's been highlighting that there is some perverse incentives between some of the private credit funds, the private equity funds, and insurance companies as it pertains to related party dealings. And Mark Walters finds himself at the center of this. This is a pretty wild story.
Yeah. I'm not going to try to dissect the arcana of all of the different kind of relationships here. It is it's quite a complex web that has been woven. And you're right, you know, Nick has some good coverage on it. You've written some newsletters on it. If you want, you can kind of go off on some of the details. I wanted to throw it on here just because it's, you know, a couple of years ago or maybe like last year, Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan said after a couple, you know, small issues were popping up in private credit or kind of the cuspier, you know, lower quality parts of the credit market, these small places, you know, he was saying like, when you see one cockroach, you know, they're a lot more kind of hiding somewhere, right? So people have been, you know, waiting for and looking for all the, you know, the bigger cockroaches or the larger group of cockroaches to kind of emerge in private credit and in kind of the more exotic, you know, credit complex in the U.S. And time will tell if this is, you know, one of the big starting guns for a lot more of those cockroaches to emerge. I just thought it was to maintain kind of a balanced view here. I thought it was helpful to keep in mind, like, this is one of the big, you know, constraints that I think under the hood that the admin's current strategy faces, which is that, you know, the U.S. has a massive, at the federal level, has a massive debt problem. There may be a, you know, a meaningful problem in certain parts of kind of the private credit complex as well. And, you know, you could say, well, it's only such and such many billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, maybe $1 trillion of total, you know, total blast radius or whatever. And, you know, various different, you know, private credit executives have kind of made a point like that over the past year that, you know, the real risk is quite small and, you know, it's only a part of the market. And maybe that's true. But I think if you look back at all recent, you know, crisis moments in U.S. financial history, you know, it's generally touched, the impact is like nonlinear, right? Like it's generally touched off by, you know, something that initially looked kind of small, but because of we're in such a massive debt-based system with all these daisy chaining impacts, like something that starts small can have chain reaction impacts that you weren't quite expecting around, you know, other parts of the economy. Not saying that's going to happen here, but this is the kind of thing that I think, this is the kind of thing that blows up your strategy, right? If you're trying to fight the, you know, the China the China proxy war and the Iran war, and you're trying to, you know, make sure that there's enough credit and enough general financial liquidity for the AI build out and to win on that front, you know, the kind of thing that blows that all up is, you know, a daisy chain collapse of exotic, you know, credit instruments that, you know, takes down like a regional bank or something, right? So just something to watch and something to kind of, you know, as we try to take an honest, balanced view of like what are the puts and takes of the U.S.'s position. I mean, this is obviously one that it could be, you know, a major risk to the that strategy going forward.
I mean, this story is wild. It's like he had his insurer own the TV rights to the Dodgers, like as a long term asset backing liabilities. It's pretty insane. Pretty insane. We will, to John's point, who knows whether or not this is systemic and it will domino and daisy chain into something much broader and higher impact, but something to keep an eye on as it unfolds. Short deck, six slides this week. Last slide we have here is on Trump family-backed crypto firm World Liberty gets conditional charter approval from the OCC. Big topic this week, mentioned in the beginning. Like I said, despite the fact the Clarity Act has not passed, looks like the powers that be within the administration are going to be pushing forward with the sort of onboarding of crypto digital asset firms to the traditional financial system. And speaking of related parties, we have World Liberty getting their charter here. So just really confirming what we said at the beginning. There's nothing stopping this train of creating this infrastructure on the back end.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think there's no, I guess, no strong affiliation or strong affinity from us towards something like World Liberty Fi or, you know, any other. Someone not me might say things that look like, you know, self-dealing among, you know, politicians and, you know, DeFi in general, right? Like whether there's like a self-dealing issue or not, you know, a lot of the things that I would imagine World Liberty Fi is going after are not that, don't seem that interesting to me and don't seem sustainable. So I'm less, you know, interested in that piece, but just again, as a sign of the times of where this administration is focused, and you've got the World Liberty Fi, you know, headline. We can kind of, you know, maybe people can laugh at that or kind of roll their eyes at that. But I think the OCC statement that, you know, the significant amount of new OCC applications for bank charters are related to digital assets, quote unquote, you know, up massively from Biden administration. I mean, you're seeing clearly like where the industry is trying to move, and clearly with the encouragement of the administration, and I think especially guys like Scott Bessent and the Treasury. And, you know, it's just a bunch of data points stacking up to kind of like make you ask the question or make you consider like if there is a global economic reordering being attempted, and if there is a desire to get within that, to wrest more control of the dollar system away from the kind of international central banking cabal that, you know, some people might call it that, again, not me, and toward a more, let's say, like sovereign oriented system where the US Treasury has, you know, maybe more control over the dollar system and what it means to hold a dollar. If you thought that might help go a long way to explain the administration's interest in stablecoins, which if you squint could kind of look like, you know, the dollar system pre-1913, where, you know, privately issued banknotes were primarily collateralized by U.S. treasuries and T-bills. And if you thought that was a gambit that was being attempted, you might also ask yourself, what would go a long way to further making the, you know, the treasury backing of the new digital dollar more appealing and more credible. And I think the last quote on here, which we can end on, may help to answer that question to some extent. You know, Trump being asked at a crypto press conference, a digital assets press conference, you know, on if the U.S. would look to buy significantly more Bitcoin. And he basically said, I'll defer to Paul Atkins and the whole group. You know, they'll make a decision and I'll listen. I think there are an increasing amount of breadcrumbs suggesting that there is an appetite for a new dollar system run more and influenced more by the Treasury that may have you know, certain characteristics that you know, look quite different than what we've had for, you know, the last 100 years. And so a lot of things can go wrong with that, or a lot of things can throw it off the path and you know, make that kind of not manifest in the way that I might be imagining. But you know, I think it's worth, you know, considering the right tail implications, you know, of that if that plays out.
Yeah. No, I will say Paul Atkins spotted a PubKey DC a few weeks ago. Just something to note there. And one more thing I want to say before we wrap up, but I completely forget what I was going to say. So, John, we'll end it there. We'll be back next week. I remember what I was going to say between now and next week when we record Jackson Hole Economic Symposium. It's going to happen. So we should have some good fodder next week.
Yep.
All right. See you guys.